Hello, welcome to High and Low, a Kershaw podcast. I'm your host, Spencer, and with me, with the first episode of the new year, is the regular co-host, J-Dog.
Hello, my name is J-Dog. No, Joel. Hey, what's up?
Yeah, it's the new year. It's our first episode of 2018.
Mm-hmm. Gotta start it off right.
Yeah, because this, I think, this is the last year, because we're going to run out by December. This episode is the second half of the 1990 pairing. We're cheating a little bit, because in Hideo Gosha directed Hunter in the Dark, the episode we did in October, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe so, yeah. And this is one of his later films called Heat Wave, starring his favorite go-to star, Tatsuya Nakadai.
I mean, it's not really starring him. He just happens to be in it.
Yeah. Okay, he's a supporting role in it.
He's a major character. I mean,
yeah.
He's important to the plot, but it's not... It's like those DVDs that come out that are reprints of movies that happen to have an actor that was famous, or that's famous now, that wasn't when the movie originally came out.
Mm-hmm.
Can't think of something off the top of my head.
Airheads.
Airheads. Now it's like Adam Sandler centric.
Well, Airheads is like, it stars Steve Buscemi and Adam Sandler and Brendan Fraser.
Yeah.
Yeah, but no one cares about Brendan Fraser. So Heatwave stars Kanako Higuchi. Higuchi, she was in her 30s at the time. So she's kind of got more famous later on with like stuff that doesn't really get released over here that widely or that easily available over here.
Oh wow, 26 Zatoichi movie after that actor had retired from the role, they brought him back, and she's in that one. She's in Kashern, which is a live action version of a manga and anime. That also, I think there's another actor in this movie that's in this. Let me see. Maybe the brother. Yeah, it looks like she's done a lot of roles since then. That this is, I mean, this is like, she is the star of
yeah,
this movie.
I want to see more of her stuff. It's just like, a lot of stuff ain't streaming. You gotta buy an import or whatever. And, well, really, movies center around her and the Nakadai. Who was the other guy? Who played the big boss? He seemed kind of bored the whole time.
Yeah, well, I mean, he doesn't do anything. He's the man with the straight face, so he doesn't really have to do anything.
He seems tired half the time.
Uh-huh. Let's see. That is... Yeah, I have no idea. I don't know what the character's name is. Is it Rio Katase, or is it...
I don't know. But, yeah, so it's kind of those three mainly. There's a bunch of side characters...
The brother Ishitaro, he doesn't have a lot of speaking in the movie, but the actor is kind of famous. I mean, I kind of forgot
he was in the movie.
You just watched it.
I know, but like, he's the most forgettable part.
Oh, he's got such a handsome face, though. When you first see him, you're like, who's this young man?
Not really. Sure.
He's in the movie Departures, which has made the rounds in the U.S. I think it might have been nominated for some award. And let's see, who else?
He's in a comedy I'm trying to get a hold of that we can cover, Sumo Do, Sumo Don't.
It sounds terrible.
It's a sports comedy about sumo wrestling from 92.
He's also in Shall We Dance. Mm. You know that movie, right?
No.
Oh, man. Okay. It was remade with, like, Richard Gere and Jennifer Lopez.
Richard Gere, the star of Rhapsody in August?
Yes. That, Richard. Oh. But the Japanese version came out, you know, several years beforehand. That version was very popular before it was remade.
Mm.
I think J-Lo has a song in the remake, though.
Mm.
So, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, like, this is... For us, kind of one of the more recent movies we're covering, so a lot of the actors I am not familiar with at all.
Yeah, not too many.
Although the composer, Masaru Sato, he's the guy who did Yojimbo and Bad Sleep Well, and Hunter, and he kind of worked with Gosha, in like almost all his movies, doing the music.
So this is very similar to the style of What was the other one? Hunter in the Dark.
Yeah.
Except I'd say this is way more flashy and way more of a like a tribute to a certain style of film. Like you're way more familiar with the 60s and 70s style film than
yeah.
this is kind of like paying
homage yeah, it's to. A tribute to like the Toei Dai like low budget Yakuza movies from the era. Like not like Joshoshio Yakuza movies, more like the older set ones. With the whole subgenre. And yep. this one is about a woman gambler, and there was a 17 movie series in the 60s that was about a woman gambler and her adventures. So I think it's a kind of a tribute to that movie series.
I could see
and,
that. Yeah.
And the name of the series, I don't remember. But I don't know what it is translated to English. I saw the Japanese titles, which I...
So we do a lot of research on this podcast, is what we're saying. We just, you know, we got our numbers down.
Yeah. I know there's 17 movies that are impossible to find over here.
17 is a good number.
Yeah.
Yeah. I watched this with Sarah, and she was talking about how... The time feels all over the place because mm-hmm. obviously it's a movie from 1991 throwing back to the
60s
the 60s era style of filmmaking along with it taking place in like 1928, so it's also trying to ride that line at the same mm-hmm. time. But yeah, this like it's in the beginning. I'll just go into it. This movie opens with the actress showing her back to the camera while she bathes in what it's supposed to be, you know, very hot. So she's trying to cool yeah. off. And we see that she's got full body tattoos.
Yeah, like the old, like a Yakuza style tattoo.
Exactly, yeah.
That you, I don't know if those still exist, but you see a lot in movies.
Yeah, there's. I mean, that's. It must have been a time period where that was a thing
yeah.
because they certainly show that, especially not just in movies, but in video game representation. It's just like you'll have the full, you know, demon on your back or the full Buddha, you know.
Interesting, you bring up Buddha.
Well, you know, he's staring at you right in the beginning.
Yeah. Wait, she has a red. Buddha tattoo?
Yeah. And it's the more jolly version, you know, I don't know. I actually don't really know the differences between the representations of Buddha.
Yeah. I don't know Buddhism that well.
Yeah.
Either.
I feel like a sap. I wish I looked more into that particular thing because that stuff does actually fascinate me. I'm too busy watching movies about Japanese gangsters and, you know, Jason versus Freddy.
Yeah. Why not Jason X, the good one?
I haven't got there yet. I'm working it's my way up.
Okay. Yeah, to the good one, I know.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, the shot is her taking a bath and the hot sun in it looks like it's clearly very artificial, but it totally works in the movie.
It's a gorgeous shot, and this whole movie is just like this is something it has in common with Dreams. It is like painterly, and the cinematography is just
yeah.
fantastic about it. Like everything can be taken from a frame and just presented as, you know, this museum piece. It's really good that way.
Yeah, yeah, and uses color very smartly too.
Yeah, it's not like in your face, like, look at what we can do. Because I imagine even at that time, like, this seems like it had a budget and it wasn't like we're trying to do a Hollywood spectacular either. But it color was used subtly, but also like I feel Gosha has a real firm grasp on what he wants in a frame.
Yeah, this goes back to Hunter in the Dark. This is much more easy to follow.
Yeah.
Yeah, Hunter in the Dark, I'm still not sure what the plot was exactly still.
Yeah, there were a lot of twists. Well, that's another thing that this has in common with Hunter in the Dark. Obviously, same director. But the plot here doesn't seem to be as important as, like, you paying attention to what's going on, like, action-wise on the screen. Not to say that this is, like, an action-packed movie, but this movie just kind of throws plot details, like, all over the place.
Yeah.
And it just slides out like the water sliding off the actress's back. Oh, my gosh, I'm a poet. Yeah, yeah, but my chief complaint about this movie is that it doesn't have a plot that is important whatsoever.
Yeah, it's kind of more this visual and pretty to look at.
Yeah,
it's like the opposite of Hunter in the Dark, where Hunter Dark was all about plot, whereas like it was too much, and this is the extreme end of the extreme opposite end, where there's not enough plot.
Right, yeah. It seems like the purpose of this movie was, like, I have a whole bunch of ideas for scenes, and, okay, there's a little bit of plot we can include in them, but I really need to get this scene, and this scene, and this scene, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, obviously, they're gambling, we gotta have a couple of gambling scenes, we got, you know, we got some sexiness going on, we gotta show that there's some sleaziness.
Well, Scotia, you gotta include it.
I got this idea for a flashback. Here, we're going to show you a flashback a couple times.
Yeah. We haven't moved on from the late first 2 minutes. So, wait, does it go straight to a flashback after that?
No, it starts off with...
It's her on a train station.
Right, she's on her way to a job that she's been hired for, which is... She works as a professional gambler, and people pay her to gamble at their facility or on their behalf.
Yeah, Yakuza gangs do.
And while she's on the train, she has this kind of weird, not flashback, but like flash to a different scene where she is presenting herself in a very, very dramatic, for lack of better term, anime way, where she's like, I am Rin of blah, blah, blah.
Oh, yeah.
The daughter of the hoo-hoo, sa-sa-la-la-la-la-la, and I have come here to blah-blah-blah, boo-boo-boo, whoosh, you know?
Yeah.
And it's really out of context. It doesn't have...
it's a thing that's in girl gang movies in the 70s.
Ah, okay. Yeah, I didn't get it.
Yeah, I've seen that a lot. It's kind of silly, but I'm used to it.
Yeah. And she's on the train, and eventually gets to where she's going, and when she gets off, she is met by the representative of the person who's going to hire her, and there you go. His boss is very excited to...
Yeah, from the Masa family.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and, excited to meet you.
Yeah.
And everything's cool, except for all of a sudden this goofball comes running along. And he, like, makes eye contact with Rin, and they immediately recognize each other. Like, oh, what? Whoa, whoa.
Yeah, what? And it turns out that is her brother, who I guess he tried to get out of a game he was losing with another Yakuza family, and he owes 300 yen. And he gets caught, and his big sister offers to bail him out, but her Yakuza buddy is like, no, 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 you're a woman, I'll pay for you.
Yeah. And there's you know, a little bit of delving out of the story here. We see that he's somebody who's in debt, and like, he shouldn't even be here. He should be back in their hometown taking care of the restaurant or working with her parents. That's... Yeah. She hasn't had contact with her parents for a while, and we find out after this point, she decides that she's going to take her brother back to the hometown.
Yeah, and she apologizes to the Yakuza
gang. And they actually seem to handle it very well.
Yeah, like they are familiar with who she is. Mm-hmm. Like, it's clear she has a reputation for being like an honorable person. Mm-hmm. And so you would think this would maybe come back in a bad way. Quite the opposite.
Yeah, it's actually kind of refreshing in that case. But it was more like, even though, like, he's that particular person that was there to get her was a tough guy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel like his boss was actually a Yakuza member. I feel like he was just a very high-up businessman who had some people, you know, like mm-hmm. they're the Masa family, so maybe they did have connections, but...
Yeah, well, family basically means Yakuza gang.
He didn't really do anything, like, that seems shady.
Yeah.
Other than take place, you know...
He has a gambling den, and that's kind of all you know.
Wait, what are you saying about gambling dens here? Are you accusing people that go gambling dens and gambling dens himself of being shady?
No, it's perfectly legal.
Exactly. Wink! No. So, while they're taking the train back to the hometown, we get another flashback. And none of these flashbacks are presented like it's not like, you know, 1918 or whatever. We only got one time where they told us what year it was.
Yeah, it's summer 1928. So that's, and you see people fanning themselves and sweating all the time.
That's why they're having a heat wave.
Yeah. The Japanese title is
Kagero,
yeah. Which I'm not sure if it actually means heat wave, because not a lot of time it is literal, but sometimes it isn't. Like Autumn Afternoon, the Ozu film.
Yeah.
Do you know the literal translation of the title?
Mm.
The actual name of the movie in Japan is The Taste of Mackerel.
Wait, for what movie?
Autumn Afternoon.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Delicious.
Because it's subtle and kind of grows on you like an Ozu film. That's why Ozu picked it. Came to America, they're like, oh, we need a better name than mackerel.
That's better than the smell of mackerel. anyway.
Yeah.
I think it might actually translate to heat wave, because I looked up Kagero on Google, and mm-hmm. there's another movie that came up called Heat Haze Theater.
Oh.
So it's heat something.
Okay.
Mm. But yeah, it doesn't translate it directly. That's okay. So in this flashback, we see a man gambling at a table, at a game. And do you know what this game is called?
No, I've seen it in a bunch of movies, and I am still not sure what the rules are.
Yeah, I'm mostly familiar with it from the Zatoichi, since he's like a notorious gambler himself.
Yeah, like I've seen it a bunch of times, but I'm still not sure what exactly it's supposed to be. Kind of like in the James Bond movies with Baccarat, where it's like, you know, that card game they always play. In French.
Yeah, I play Baccarat all the time. What are you talking about?
Okay. Well, I have Casino Royale, the book, and they go, and then, like, there's a 3-page explanation of the rules of it, actually. I should probably read it.
Oh, thank goodness.
Yeah.
That's why I got that book.
Yeah, that's the exact reason.
Actually, I was in Vegas a couple weeks ago, and I saw a huge electronic Baccarat machine that I've never seen before, but it was like, you know, I don't know if you've ever seen those poker or blackjack machines. Those are just like little, you know, single unit slot machine type things. Yeah. This looked like an electronic version of a table that you would actually sit at with a dealer.
Hmm.
So it had like 4 seats. I was like, I'm not going to try that, but that's interesting.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't like casinos.
Well, I don't blame you. They're disgusting.
Yeah.
And I'm a disgusting person for going to one.
No, it's fine. I think they feel weird, and I don't like the atmosphere in a casino or gambling really at all.
Understandable. He hates gamblers and gambling rooms. Anyway.
True.
So, in this flashback, we see the guy playing this card game, whatever it is, tile game or whatever. And the dealer shows what he has underneath his little towel. And the person we're watching presents his tile. And it's a winning tile. Although I'm not sure how that works. I just know it's a winning tile because of what happens in the movie.
Yeah, I think it's supposed to, like, there are pairs of the tiles that match, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're not the same thing. So I think it's, like, they have to be, like, a pair or something.
I see, yeah. Mm. Yeah. And, well, after he does this, a couple of people grab him from behind. The dealer reaches over and flips over a little flap that's on the tile. It's a cheater's tile. And they says, somebody says, you think you could have got away with that? But he gets up and runs out of the room. And he grabs his daughter, who's in the other room with him, I think.
Yeah, and she is watching the whole game.
Yeah. And they try to make a break for it.
And I believe she's holding a pinwheel.
Yeah. And they go and he stashes her somewhere real quick while he's trying to run away. Because the cops are also, you know, running around looking for people. And as he's trying to get away, suddenly he's confronted by the man that we saw dealing. And this man is also covered in full back tattoos. He's got everything there.
He had a blue Buddha.
And his daughter, I didn't think it was Buddha. I thought it was a demon. It's got, like, fangs and stuff.
Maybe it was a demon, but it was blue.
Yeah, it's a cookie monster.
Yeah.
And his daughter witnesses as, or the daughter witnesses as her father is stabbed by this Yakuza member. And all she can see is that he has this tattoo. He's covered with sweat. You know,
I think she sees his face.
Oh, I didn't remember.
But we don't see his face.
Right, we don't see it.
Yeah.
And that's it. Her father's dead.
And and the police are trying to question her, and she's emotionally shut down.
This guy's being a real a-hole. Like,
yeah, they're kind of being awful.
That one cop is like, no, you need to be nicer. And the other cop's like, shut up. I'm going to talk to her. Tell her so did it, little girl.
And then this rich person comes by. He's like, I'll take care of her.
I'll take the girl.
Yeah, and they're like, okay, she's legally your daughter now.
Sounds good to me. Yep, so him and his wife take her home, and they're just hanging out. And
his pregnant wife?
No, she already had a baby.
Oh, she already did?
Yeah, doesn't have her with her right there.
Oh, because I remember they did say, I can't have any more children.
Yeah, they're something. Just hanging out, and she's like, the doctor said I'm too weak to have another child. Let's adopt this one.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, okay. And they happen to own a famous restaurant. They keep calling it a restaurant, but it's gigantic if it's a restaurant.
Yeah, it's... Yeah, they seem to have, like, pleasure women there, too?
Well, I don't see any, like, before traded over, but...
I guess it is, a fancy restaurant.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's like a palace.
Exactly, yeah. Like, it's got, like, the full garden in the middle. It's got multiple floors. It's big, but I mean, I guess maybe that's just to show that he's rich.
Yeah.
So these two people grow up together. You know, the little baby and the girl who she's like 3 or 4, right?
I got like maybe a little older.
Yeah, maybe 5, 6.
Yeah.
7, 8, 9, 10, 11. No. And they grow up together as mother, you know, as sister and brother. And
yeah.
It's during this flashback we're hearing Rin talk about, you know, how her life was wonderful and her parents were wonderful and she was want for nothing, but there was always something burning inside her. And we see a moment where the kid is now like 6 or 7, the boy, and she is probably like 11, like 10 or 11.
I got more like maybe she's like puberty just started to hit.
I think she's still pre-pubescent. It bothered me that she seemed so young, and then she decided she was going to run off. But I'm not sure. I'm not good at estimating children's ages.
Yeah, it's she's at least 11 years old, mm-hmm. and he's, you know, like first grade age, and he's being bullied by his bullies.
He's being bullied by like every bully in the neighborhood.
I can't remember. I didn't write down what they were bullying him for exactly.
They were saying like your sister is a thieves.
Oh, that's it.
Or is a gambler's daughter, and she's adopted, and you know, they were just being jerks.
Yeah, and they're saying like she's a daughter of a yakuza.
Mm-hmm. And so she goes in and rescues the kid, but one more kid has to say something, and her response is to pick up a big old. It's
a like stick. A
nearby piece of wood and just start smacking him. Just smacking the crap out of him.
Yeah, it reminded me of the neighbor boy from Totoro that in the beginning.
The kid with the umbrella?
Yes.
Yeah.
I kind of got, like if he was just a mean jerk instead of, like, an awkward boy.
Awkward preteen, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they're all wearing the same clothes. They must only sell that kind of clothes there.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, we see her smacking the crap out of him, and then it flashes forward a little bit when their sister and brother are running away, and Rin is like, I'm going to leave. Don't tell our parents what happened, and don't tell them that I left. Well, he's like, no, don't go. And she's like, I have to do this, you jerk face.
Yeah. And she goes on to a life of gambling.
Yeah, the rest we just kind of have to fill in that because it doesn't ever do another flashback, I don't think.
No, it's kind of like Jesus in the Bible. Like, after he's 10, we don't know what happened for 20 years.
Oh, okay, so she went into the desert. Yeah.
I don't know. She was tempted by a blue demon.
Spencer, I'm excited to tell you about these series of Anne Rice novels that tell you about what happened to Christ in between those years.
I can't tell if you're joking or not.
I'm not.
Oh.
I haven't read them myself, but.
Hmm. Okay.
So, yeah, we flash forward. We're going back to the town, and it turns out that a little brother here, whose name is
Ichiro. Ichiro.
Ishitaro.
Yeah.
Which they say 1,000 times has gambled away the inheritance. Both their parents have passed away, and he inherited the house, or the restaurant, and he has lost it to some of the local Yakuza, who now run it as kind of a brothel. Brothel slash restaurant slash hotel.
But they kept some of the staff.
Yeah. Yeah, they just moved in, basically, and started doing all of their business dealings out of it.
Yeah, and, so are at the point where they are at the hometown again?
I think we flash forward into it, yeah.
Yeah, and so, Ren goes to the restaurant, and she's kind of playing innocent, like, I'm this looking around. I used to come here all the time type thing. And she kind of slyly reveals to, I think, the madam that Ichitaro is still alive and she knows where he is, but she won't reveal where he is.
Right,
and
this particular Yakuza wants this kid dead.
Yeah. This guy who, Otaki, who seems very bored the whole time.
Mm-hmm. He's got two women, or he's got one woman falling all over him, and then another woman who's obviously in charge, like either his partner or his wife or whatever.
Yeah.
There's one lady who's just like crawling, like literally almost crawling all over him, trying to get him to do stuff.
Yeah, and we see walking down the stairs, we see Nakadai, wearing all black, and he sees Ren, and he stops, and he's like, exactly, he makes that noise. And then I think she sees him, and is like, oh, it's him.
Yep.
And then she kind of was like, oh, I gotta get out of here.
And they've already talked about his character kind of in the past. Like, when you're skipping over the part where we're introduced to this entire Yakuza. And I think the director's intention was here to make sure that we knew that these were sleazy mother effers, because they're watching a performance, in quotation marks.
A woman dressed like a man
and a woman. A man and a woman, and they're doing sexual stuff on each other.
Yeah, it's like Sweetback's badass song, where he's a sex performer.
I did not like seeing this. I don't like it. Shame on you, Gush. If the purpose was to make me uncomfortable, you did it.
I think... I don't know, he seems to like this.
Yeah.
But, never mind. I was going to say it's kind of like Sweetback's badass song, where it's like a sex performance, because in the movie Sweetback, he has sex in front of crowds for money.
Mm.
It's an interesting movie with a weird child abuse angle, if you like, look into it. But it's not child abuse like you usually typically would think of it. It's more a strange form of it that happened on set.
Verbal and mental.
He forced his son to do a scene that a 13-year-old boy should have not been doing in the first place.
I'll be the judge of that. Not really. I'm not going to look at that.
It's a good movie.
I assume this particular part in this movie was also part of the throwback, you know?
Yeah.
Because a lot of those 60s and 70s movies were all about, you know, the titillating, you know, nudity.
It depends what studio. If it's Nikkatsu, yes. Because Nikkatsu, the Roman porno. Roman mean romantic.
Yeah.
They had a rule of every 10 minutes, nudity or sex.
Mm.
And everything else, do whatever. It doesn't matter.
Makes sense. But yeah, I mean, that's a small scene, but it does introduce a lot of the plot details. Like, they're going to have a gambling tournament.
And the winner will get the restaurant, because Otaki doesn't want to manage it anymore.
Mm-hmm. And they've already got a person there representing them who they call Soon the unmovable or something.
Unmovable. And they're like, where is he? Like, oh, he's upstairs drinking.
Like, oh, he's getting drunk, but isn't that bad? It's like, no, the drunker he gets, the better the gambler he is.
Yeah, and you know, they cut to him just laying down, drinking, and Koyoshi.
Mm-hmm. Another character that's important, kind of.
Yeah, she's very desperate to... She's trying to sleep with him.
She's telling him that she's willing to give him whatever he wants if he's willing to take her money and, like, quadruple it for her. Not even quadruple. It's like, if I get 17 times the amount, I can buy the restaurant. Like, she wants the restaurant for some reason.
Yeah, because... Well, we learn later, like, her history with the restaurant.
Right. Yeah, right afterwards, when Rin is at the restaurant for the first time, we get reintroduced to this person who works as a trafficker of women, but he knows Rin. He's, like, old family friend.
Yeah.
And so he, like, I believe she's, like, staying with him. Since he's one of the only few familiar faces that she knows. But there's another reason why they have a connection. And as Rin is leaving the restaurant after everyone sees her and recognizes that she has some connection to it, Koyoshi confronts her outside and says, Is Ichitaro, you know, back? Is he really here? You know him? She's like, yeah, he's here, and he's safe. She's like, well, take him to me, or take me to him immediately, you know, like we, and she's not quite saying that we're engaged, but that's what you're supposed to get. And she's like, no, I think you're a nice person, but I'm not going to tell anyone where he is right now.
I believe that's when you cut to Ichitaro, and he's just hanging out in a hot summer. And he sees a woman sell her daughter. Is that woman, does that woman show up again? No? Okay. I wasn't sure if she was supposed to be someone we knew.
No, and the daughter only shows up for one more second too, but yeah.
Okay.
Basically, this man traffics in women, and he assures her that, he's going to take care of her and blah 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 and stuff like that. The funny thing is, even though he's got this kind of detestable position, he comes off as a likable person because he's like helping the main characters. So that put me in a very weird state of feeling. Like, I don't like this guy, but he's also a nice guy.
I mean, he means well. He
Sure.
can't, I'm sure he did something else before.
Yeah.
And they kind of forced, and he tells Ren that nobody likes working with the Otaki gang.
'Cause they suck.
Yeah, he mentioned something like everyone hates them.
Yeah. They're pretty terrible. And he's yeah, like you said, he's hiding Itchy up in his upper room. So, and he keeps telling him like, don't poke your head out. Like, if somebody recognizes you, you're dead, and I'm a dead. So cut that shit out. It's like, I just want to see my girlfriend. Like, dude, calm down. You see your girlfriend later. And eventually they find his location. In between that, we see a scene where Rin is practicing dealing cards, dealing these tiles.
Yeah, and this scene is really great because you see like her focus and getting ready, and like it's mostly cuts to like body parts and seeing like the sweat and like subtle movement that she's doing, and there's a mirror, and yeah, she's topless, but it's not, doesn't feel like exploitative. It's just kind of like she just happens to be nude in this scene.
Like the motions of her body are more important than the fact that she happens to be topless.
And I think
It's
it's silent too. I don't remember there being music.
is silent, and I can tell you that for a fact because there are every once in a while you'll hear thunder crash. And it actually like made me jump because I'm concentrating. You're concentrating on her eyes or you're concentrating on her hand, and she's got this like specially made cup that is fitted to her shoulder that she fills to the brim, and she's trying to move the tiles without spilling any of the water. You know, it's like taking incredible muscle control to do this.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I guess she's trying to hide her tell, probably.
Right, exactly, yeah. And it's yeah, like it's completely silent, you're concentrating, you are starting to feel like kind of like tension that she's feeling, and then all of a sudden, boom. So, because it is pouring, even though it's like this crazy heat wave, it is pouring rain outside every
Yeah.
once in a while.
And a certain someone barges into the room.
Yep. It's the man with no name. Oh wait, it's soon. Nakadike shows up and he's like, "So, you've come back. Did you come for revenge?" And she's like, "Huh?" But there's, he knows who she is, and he even knows that her reputation as a gambler. He's been like following her career or something.
Yeah, and I guess at some point he figured out who she was.
Yeah.
Well,
And
that's not explained, but it's not important.
right. And he basically tells her, like, if you challenge me, you're going to lose. It's just the way it is. Like, I know that you have a reputation as an amazing gambler, but there's no way. And he just like leaves.
He has some great lines that I screenshotted. One is, "I'll devour you and your tattoo down to the bone."
Nice.
And he said, "I want you to hate me in your guts before the game. Consider this the least mercy I can show you." And it's like, oh, this is why Nakadai is a great villain.
Yeah. And as he's leaving, he says, this is one more thing that'll get you fired up. And he reveals the tattoo that we saw in the flashbacks. Just in case we didn't know it was him already, he just confirmed that this is the guy who murdered her father.
No, it's the next time. No, because their relationship doesn't develop in the way you would think it would.
Nothing develops in the way you would think it would in this movie.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that it's, like, super creative. It just kind of doesn't really care.
Like, yeah.
It's just a progression of plot. So, the guy who's trafficking women decides that he's not as smart as he appeared to be and goes and gets Koyoshi, the young lady we saw before looking for Ichi. And he takes her to to where he's statuing Ichi. And of course they Ichi and Koyoshi get hot and heavy because they're lovers. And
yeah.
They're dedicated to each other. It's like, there's one point where he says, like, he said that, or she mm-hmm. once told me that she wants to die when I die so that we can always be together. Like, oh yeah. Romeo and Juliet and shit.
Yeah, they're in love.
And while they're doing this, suddenly some men show up outside of the trafficker's house. And he says, like, listen, I know you know that he's here, but please, they're just young lovers. You know, they need a chance. Please don't hurt them or anything like that. And there's kind of a screwed up scene where he's like, mm-hmm. he's on the ground kneeling or like begging for them not to do this. And one of the guys like picks up his shoes and puts them on his head.
Oh yeah.
And then the other guy takes a pot of boiling water and dumps it on his back.
Yeah. Kind of like it's kind of like an female prisoner scorpion grudge song. There's a flashback to a character who's a love interest, the only love interest in all the movies. And he gets tortured by police and they pour boiling water on his groin. And you learn he has a misshapen penis. And that's why he never tries to hook up with any women.
Yeah, I don't think I would do anything after somebody pours boiling water on my penis, but that's just me.
In the first scene, like, he works at a strip club, and like one was like, why don't you try hook up with me? And he just unzips his pants and shows her, and then she walks away.
It's a curlicue.
Yeah.
You're like a duck down there. That ain't gonna work.
You never see it, but I imagine, you know, boiling water would ruin you.
Yeah.
But this fight scene gets pretty funny, where the woman trafficker, he gets like a butcher knife, lifts it up, and it gets stuck in the ceiling.
Yeah, and Ichi is already knew something was going down because he could hear it, I guess, and so he's already climbed through a skylight in the roof that we saw a couple times, and he's trying to pull. Trying to pull Koyoshi through it, but he doesn't quite get her tied high enough, so she gets pulled down. And they say, take her back to the restaurant, put her in the lock her in the basement. So that's what's going to happen to her.
Yeah.
And yeah, like you said, the trafficker comes up with his knife, and it gets it stuck in the thing, and he gets stabbed to death for his, you know.
Yeah, it's like in Hunter in the Dark, where the guy cuts off the guy's hand, and the hand holding the sword is stuck in the ceiling.
Oh, yeah. He likes that. He likes sticking knives in the ceilings.
Yeah, I want to see more of his movies, see if that recurs.
That's his motif.
Yeah, a sleazy strip performance, and someone getting a knife stuck in the ceiling.
Makes sense. And so Ichi does escape, but he injures himself when he's trying to, because he has to slide off the roof. Rin catches up with him later because, there's like a circus in town. There just happens to be this circus in town.
Yeah, traveling kabuki theater or something.
Mm-hmm. And they find Itchy and take him in, even though they don't know who he is. Because these are the nice kind of circus people, not like those evil ones.
Yeah, they there's an old man named Bushu, who's like, yeah, I'll help you out. And he puts him on this contraption for the play that you pull a rope and goes to the ceiling. And he hides up there, and the gangsters show up. And old man's like, I don't know what you're talking about.
He's like, you already missed the show, geniuses. Yeah, this old man is cool. He does not take any guff.
Yeah, he's a lot of fun. And I love this a shot of Itchy on the platform just looking down. And I was expecting like a Spider-Man scene from the first Sam Raimi movie where like blood drips while he's on the ceiling type thing to happen. But it's like, oh, what?
Itchy was going to kiss the old man while upside down.
That would be even better, but...
Oh, apparently not. Yeah, so he successfully hides him. Hold on.
You okay?
Yeah, I'm just joking.
Okay.
And Rin contacts the boss that we saw before that was excited for her. And she tells him about the deal that they're going to do. In fact, I think she leaves town to go talk to him.
Yeah. And he's very jovial, and he's like, yeah, that's fine. We respect you. And they decide to be her sponsor for the tournament. And he even gets her a special new kimono.
Yeah, this is the nicest guy.
Yeah.
I wish he was my Yakuza boss.
Yeah, I want to work with these guys. They're nice.
Mm-hmm. Guy with the glasses is like, whatever you need, we'll take care of
him. Yeah, he looks like a dork, but you don't mess with him.
No, man, he's an ass kicker.
That
part where he pulls back that lesser Yakuza guy and he's like, I am blah 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 of the Masa family. Do you want to spit on this family emblem? And he like pushes his face into it. It's like,
Yeah, and so she gets a sponsor and they're like, oh, who are you going up against? And she's like, oh, Tsune the Immovable. And they're like, oh.
Ooh. That's crazy.
Yeah.
And then from this, it feels like there's like a cascade of like no story where we just want to like, okay, let's get into this gambling thing that we keep talking about. Like,
yeah, it's more of the game that at this point, I should know the basic rules, which I think they are, you flip the card, and the dealer, I think, maybe supplies the money for that round.
Well, the dealer has his, like, people are betting on the dealer, but they're also betting on the individual gamblers.
Okay.
The dealer himself gets turned from person to person around the table.
Yeah, every round.
Yeah. And that person takes a series of tiles, moves the tiles behind his back, picks one at random, and then places them into a cloth that he folds over and then puts on the table. Once they put that on the table, then the other gamblers at the table choose tiles from their own set. And they also put down whatever gambling amount, whatever money they want to bet against, either against the dealer or for the dealer.
And then there's someone who says, pick the sixth card or first card.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess if it lines up, if it's like the pair, I don't really know what the symbols mean. But it's like, I guess if they are complementary, then you win the money.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Sometimes they match, sometimes they don't. Like in the last round, they specifically don't match, but the dealer did not win that round, so I'm not sure what the situation is. Like, we'll have to look into this. We'll have to do this. But we honestly have not run into that much gambling in the podcast episodes.
No, not really. The only other gambling we ran into was, what was it, backgammon? And, Tokyo Twilight?
See, I don't even remember, yeah.
There's some gambling den where it's like checkers or something. It's like board game.
They were playing a version of Mahjong.
Mahjong, that was it.
Yeah.
Now, backgammon is a James Bond movie where they gamble on backgammon.
Yeah. Backgammon is it's a very easy game. Let me tell you about it. No, I don't know anything about it.
It's a fun game. I like
it. That was the game people. Or not backgammon. I'm thinking of Baccarat. Baccarat was the game.
Oh no, there's a James Bond movie where Bond and the villain play backgammon for money.
All right, we need to reveal to the podcast listeners right now that you and I are actually expert gamblers, that we have made millions of dollars at the tables, and we're just pretending we don't know anything about cards or gambling or what a domino is.
Yeah, it's all a ruse.
Yeah,
Shane. We've been lying to you for over a year.
Yep. So send in your checks, and we'll double it for you.
Yep.
The end. Okay, now, but this scene is a lot of men sitting behind the gamblers at the table. Sune is the dealer. And so he is the one who's showing the cards and stuff like that.
Wait, are you talking about the final round?
No, I'm talking about the... Oh, I'm sorry. It is...
That's Rin, the final
Rin is, round. Rin is the dealer.
Yeah.
And Sune is one of the gamblers. And everyone is very excited about this showdown. Like, oh, man, I'm going to put all my money on Rin. Like, they can't be beat. But Sune, you know, he's an amazing gambler, and he's unbeatable himself, and blah, blah, blah. And the boss, Rin's boss, puts all of his money on her, of course, and she ends up losing this round altogether.
Yeah.
So he loses a lot of money, and so do a lot of other people. And after this is done, you hear them saying, like, this is incredibly disappointing. Like it was... it's so difficult. It's difficult to understand how they could possibly think this... was going to be like, you know, a game of strategy or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. But after this, Ren is hanging out in a market looking at pinwheels again. And what was it? Because pinwheels show up earlier because she sees a little girl with a pinwheel. And that's a flashback to her dad getting murdered. And she's looking at pinwheels, and you see this guy with a little white mask covering his face. And he removes the mask, and it's like, oh, it's Nakatai, just creeping around.
Yeah, he loves white masks. No, he's like stalking her. He can't get enough.
Yeah, and then he kind of confesses that he feels regret for murdering her father, because he was a different man back then. And he's not as, like, I think he's starting to see, like, how evil the Otaki gang is.
Right, and how he's been kind of...
being used, I guess.
Well, he hasn't been picking a side. He's simply been doing things for his own fulfillment, but never feeling that he was actually accomplishing anything. Just simply, like, towing the line, if you will. And for the first time in his life, he's feeling this, like, fire because of her presence and because of her, you know, ability and skill and their history together. Like, he does a really... Nakadai does an amazing job of showing, like, just, like, in his dialogue, showing how important this is to his character.
Yeah, he... He says every time I'm at the table or whatever, Death is sitting across from me, she says something like, "Yeah, me too."
Mm-hmm.
And you expect him to kiss, and like, oh, no.
And then he says, "I've got a boner."
And, that kind of, like, they kind of bond, and then, yeah, that's kind of the main thing. Like, he's starting to change his ways.
Yeah. And there's, one of the weird things about the whole storyline and relationship between the two is, like, you never really get the feeling that Rin is antagonistic towards him.
Like, no, like at times she's kind of playfully, like, I'm trying to say, like she will, like, kind of, they have, like a witty, like, back and forth.
Right, repartee.
Yeah, repartee, but I feel like she is angry towards him, just trying to hide it, because Japanese women are supposed to, like, repress their emotions and not be expressive.
Yeah. Well, it's just, like, one more thing that she has to deal with. It's like, he's treating it like this is, like, the ultimate showdown, like, history has pushed them together to meet at this situation. It's just kind of like, I just wanted to get my restaurant back. Like, and you're here, and you're, like, kind of, like, bugging me. But I guess, like, yeah, it is starting to feel a lot like destiny is pushing me in this direction. But you're just a part of it. Like, it's not all you.
Yeah.
Like, I've got this, like, my old brother, my adopted family, you know, the honor of it, and, like, the murder of my father, sure, but he was also a gambler, and I am now a famous gambler. I've got these people backing me up with money, and I want to keep my reputation. And I've also got this, you know, the Yakuza family that's basically spit in my face. You know, there was this one lady that is at the restaurant. It's part of the Yakuza. She, like, every time she sees Rin, you feel like she wants to smack her.
Yeah, she's only referred to as Madam.
Yeah.
And the credits don't say Madam on IMDb, so I'm not sure who she is.
Yeah, and, like, she's just one of the, once again, another detail in this story that doesn't necessarily, it's just a means for driving the plot forward.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel important.
Like, the whole gambling thing ultimately doesn't really amount to anything. Like, it's kind of like a Imamura and, like, picking the battleships thing where it's built up and it's like, oh, it doesn't mean anything at ultimately.
Yeah.
Or like Coen Brothers, like in Hail Caesar, where the ransom money at the end, they lose it in the water.
Whoa, and, I don't know what you're talking about. Stop spoiling it.
I thought, okay, it's been over a year. It's a Coen Brothers movie. You know something like that's going to happen.
Yep.
Because money in those movies doesn't matter, ever.
Nope. Yeah, so at this point, we can't forget that our little brother is in love with this young woman who's been trapped in the basement, locked in a closet. She's trapped in a closet. Got to get out of it. Anyway, and we see her. And oh, there was also a scene where the big boss guy is interrupted after having sex with some lady, where they've got a giant ice cube and then they pour alcohol on each other. That's the first time he shows any emotion.
Well, yeah, you know he's rich because he has ice and he has an electric fan.
Mm-hmm.
I like those. What?
I was going to say, the other time you see an electric fan is in that millionaire's house.
Yeah, like everyone else. It's also, it's commenting on, like, on class, too, where, like, the people who, not people, like you clearly see, like, who has money, who doesn't have money, just by simple things like an electric fan, or who has access to an ice cube.
Yep.
Who can afford, you know, like curtains. Not curtains, but like a veil. Because he has this weird veil in his room that you can still see through it. So I'm not sure what the point of it is.
You know, it's a Japanese wall. It's like their paper walls. Come on. I don't know, man. It worked for somebody.
Yeah.
Yeah, anyways, so he gets interrupted to get told that they located where Ichitaro is. And the madam lady goes down to the basement, and she lets Kiyoshi out, and she says, we found him, and they're going to go kill him, but I have not always been wicked myself, so I want you to go and save him, so this is where he is. And she, like, gives her a note with the location on it. Kiyoshi's like, oh, thank you so much, you know, runs off. And then the other woman is like, I guess you're also an evil person or something. It's just like catty, like,
oh, yeah,
you think you're above all this, but I can see, because it turns out it's a setup.
Yeah, we didn't really mention it, but this before she wins or after she wins?
This is before she wins.
I thought, okay.
Wait, this I is thought after that was she wins.
Yeah, because she wins the match against Nakadai, and they and the gang suspects that he was in on it, because
they saw them talking when she was buying that pinwheel.
Yeah, although that's never confirmed or denied, so.
Right, there's a third gambler that's famous that was going to take Soon's place, and then he got replaced, and so he's got kind of like this, he's got a bone to pick, so he's like, obviously Soon was in on it.
Yeah, and he is nobly dressed, very Western, wearing like a white suit, and he is never sweaty the whole time.
No,
like
he's
it's
known
very...
as Jimmy the Sweatless,
but it's noticeable. Like everyone else is covered in sweat, and he's the only one who looks comfortable.
Yeah, and he's not an important character. He is absolutely external. Like it's just like an extra thing that they. I don't know if maybe this actor is a famous actor or something like that.
To me, it felt more like, oh, here's another big villain.
Right,
and
that's
like
what I was thinking.
And it's a joke of like, oh, he amounts to nothing. Like it doesn't matter.
During the showdown, this is going to be a big deal. And he actually, he is part of the thing during the showdown, but he's also not like a big deal when that happens.
Yeah. Like, I like that subverting your expectations, kind of like The Last Jedi did a lot of.
I don't like that at all.
Okay.
I want there to be a reason a thing happens.
I want to know about...
this is a big old splash. Like I said, I feel like it's just a waterfall or a river cascading towards a dam, and when the end is the dam where everything just smashes together. Sorry.
Yeah.
Didn't have time to hit the mute button for that one. So she wins that last match. Her boss is happy. He got...
Yeah, and the boss bet 1,000,000 yen, and it's I'm not sure if you noticed, but when she's getting ready in that tense scene, Nakadai bursts in, he says, "You have a 1 in a million chance to win," and I like the million coming back. Oh, and I forgot to mention it, but during their heart-to-heart, he says, oh, by the way, on my travels, I learned about this thing called dynamite.
Oh, that happens towards the end.
Towards the end? I thought that was during that scene.
No.
Okay.
Maybe? I'm not sure. See, it's just something that's thrown in. Like, somebody was like, well, it doesn't make any sense why she has dynamite. So Soon's partner in this, there was actually a guy who got him the job.
Inada.
And he knows he's in trouble since Soon lost all of this money for the big boss. And Inada goes to the big boss and he's like, I've cut off my finger. Is this enough for you? Like, no, I don't want your trash finger. If you're going to pay me back, I want you to kill Rin. It's like, oh, okay. So we get a scene where Rin is in a cemetery, And I think she's paying her respects to the person that hit her brother originally.
I thought it was her parents' grave.
I don't think so.
I can't remember.
I'm not sure. But while she's there, the circus leader guy shows up and he's like,
"Oh, the old man."
Yeah, he pours some sake on the gravestone, and they're talking about it. And then the guy who was asked to kill her shows up and he's like, "I'm sorry I have to do this, but you cost us a lot of money. And they told me that I've got to stab you with this knife I've got. It's pretty sharp." And then he's like, "Boom!" Sorry. He just gets shot.
Yeah, by the old man who's like, yep, "I'm an old man.
Yep.
Who cares?"
Like, yeah, seriously, this old man is just like, "I didn't want that guy to stab you. Here's my gun. You might need it later." She's like, why would you do this? And he's like, "Yeah, I'm an old man. Nobody really cares. You know, I can go talk to the police and then they're going to be like, whatever." So,
yeah.
Yeah, I just did it. I just do it. I don't care.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's, now we know how she got a gun.
Yeah. And she.
And we also know that she.
Oh, the brother and Kiyoshi are killed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And she finds out about that and soon goes over and is like, I'm not going to be with them anymore because I know that this is the reason, you know, I know that they killed her and stuff like that. And Jin takes this opportunity to be like, "By the way, I killed your friend, so we shouldn't be friends either." He's like, "Oh, so that's the way it's going to be." Yeah, he says that... something literally like that.
Now that's when he mentions, like, "Oh, have you heard of a thing called dynamite?"
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I ran to my travels as a gambler.
It's like a big firework.
Yeah, and she gets dynamite from some... Oh, and he warns her, like, "Oh, the restaurant." Oh, yeah. So she gets their deed to the restaurant, but then that boils down to nothing.
Yeah, she burns it. Like,
yeah, it's not.
At this is the end game for her. Like, she has nothing left as far as she's concerned with her brother dead.
Yeah, so... And Nakadai tells her, like, "Oh, yeah, the restaurant always... You got a bunch of... It's like a video game. You have a bunch of guards to take out.
There's at least 10 guards there."
Yeah.
And he also says, basically, like, "And I'll be there waiting for you, too. You know, like, we're going to have a showdown because you killed my friend."
And so Ren goes to a restaurant with dynamite, kills some people with dynamite.
And this is pretty cool. This is a cool action part. She takes out the... It's like, "I'm here to pay my respects," because they've got a little, you know, they've got a little... Because
she said that earlier, too.
I think for her parents, they've got a...
Yeah.
Whatchamacallit? A shrine.
Yeah.
And she's like, "I brought the biggest candles I could find." And she wraps it and there's just sticks of dynamite. They're like, "What the?"
You see a couple dudes fly through the air, which is really nice.
Yeah, lots of fire going on in this stuff.
It's real smoky.
Running around, and all of a sudden she's pretty good with a knife because she's stabbing some people.
Yeah, she shoots a dude in the head, mm-hmm. and you see like the headshot. And it's really cool.
Blood hit the back wall, yep.
And the Nakadai kind of wanders in, like, "Hey, like, I told you I'd be here.
I'm ready for you." And then all of a sudden, he stabs a guy that was about to stab her, and they're back to back. It's a team up.
Yeah.
No one saw this coming.
They get injured, and he gets mortally wounded, and he's like, I didn't write down their lines, but, oh yeah, he says something like, "I love you."
Yes, he's like, "I finally found the woman." Well, that's when he backs her up. He's like, "I finally found the woman I love, and I'm going to fight to the death for her." She's like, "What?"
And it's like, "Wait, why is this the movie?"
Okay.
And they have a passionate kiss, and...
Right, yeah, right
before. You have a sweet tile montage.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that feels like it... Okay.
Hold on.
What?
I want to mention that the madam and that the younger lady that were both fighting over the boss,
mm-hmm.
get into a cat fight. And that's how they take each other out.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're, like, rolling around on the stairs that are, like, on fire. And eventually they're just, like, out of the movie.
And you didn't get a title screen until the very end. And it's like
Spencer,
this.
Spencer, explain what? This to me.
Oh, okay.
What the fuck?
Okay.
I was laughing so hard.
How do I explain it?
So, Ren is there. Nakadai has just died in her arms because she got stabbed, and she's like, why does this happen? The people I love die young. The people I hate live forever. Why does the world have to be like this? And then all of a sudden there's a gigantic red moon outside.
Oh, yeah.
Followed by the tiles.
Yeah, I'm going to post up a picture of the red moon that this shows up, which I'm not sure what that's supposed to represent. And then there's this really sweet 80s montage of their all the main characters' headshots, kind of like...
It's like Swiss closing blocks or something.
It's like a PowerPoint. Mm-hmm. And like, then and it's this,
we can do with computers.
And it's this really, really aggressively 80s like guitar rock playing. And
then in the credits, like... there is a song, yes, that does not fit anything at all. It's just like, yeah.
And it's like a solo the whole time. It's like, why is that?
At the very end, we see her again, all dressed all nice, like she's ready to gamble. And it has a line at the bottom. It's like, you'll never suspect my abilities or something like that. Like a fucking anime. Spencer, explain it.
Gosha thought this would be pretty cool.
It doesn't make any sense. It's so off-putting. Like, I don't know.
I'm not...
I mean, you've seen... Are there other 60s and 70s movies that end in this particular style?
Only one I can think of is the Rika trilogy ends with her on a motorcycle riding around and the credits rolling, and then you see on the screen says, go, Rika, go on your adventures.
I'm dying.
Okay, so listeners, that's the end of the movie.
Yep.
It just takes this really, like direct-to-video weird turn at the end of, like, this was shown at Cannes, too, which I can't imagine what it was like to be at Cannes and suddenly see that happen.
maybe the entire movie is supposed to be just one throwback to, like, an episode in a series, and that's, yeah, that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah. I think like, that
maybe
might be
maybe
it
always has that rock song at the end of this imaginary series, because this movie is not part of a series, right?
No,
it's like a standalone.
And like in the 60s and 70s, it would be a pop song sung by the lead actor or actress.
Well, it's the 90s, man.
Yeah, so you gotta have guitars in it.
Now it's like ba-da-ba-ba-da.
Yeah, but let's see.
Listener, you have to watch the entire movie. You can't just skip to the end. The joke is not funny unless you watch the entire movie.
So, kind of like Dreams, this has a very dreamlike feeling to it, because a lot of it is very, like, there's a lot of rooms of people smoking, and it's really muggy, and so it looks, so just like Dreams or everything, with like, kind of misty. And not very clear. Not, I mean, like, you know what I mean? Like, have that, like, extra layer of, like, unreality to it.
Yeah, it's got a cinematic quality that is perfect for like the movie medium. You can't really show it any way else like that. Like I said in the very beginning, that just that opening shot of her bathing herself is a very dreamlike scene, and like the way it handles flashbacks as if it's not a separate part from the movie. It's just a continuation of the story that we're seeing very quickly. Like that has a dreamlike pace to it, especially the way it like flashes forward through time.
Mm-hmm.
Like we see her father murdered, and then all of a sudden she's adopted, and then later she's older, it progresses through the story that it's trying to tell. It's a 2-hour long movie, but it tells a huge amount of details. Like just from visual and from the bits of story you pick up,
yeah. And just like dreams, there's a theme of being haunted by death in it too.
Yeah.
But I don't know, it's kind of weird to compare dreams, because dreams was just like a bunch of segments.
Yeah, it's a complete, like, I could see somebody being like, I'm wondering if Heatwave was more in the normal style of movies that were popular back then. Somebody might look at Dreams and be like, this is the big budget Spielberg equivalent of what was coming out? Or is it more like an art movie? I'm not sure. Which one of these two is the art movie from 1990?
I would say Dreams has to be.
I mean, maybe. But this also feels like a niche throwback. So, this feels like a Quentin Tarantino equivalent before Pulp Fiction came out.
Yeah, like, I don't know, like, Gosher, like, he was always making, like, genre, like, action-y, low-budget, like, feeling pictures. That was his specialty.
Mm.
And this is kind of him kind of experimenting a little bit more than, like, his older stuff. Like, of his movies I've seen, this is one I like the most.
Mm.
I like it considerably more than A Hunter in the Dark, because that was just the plot in that one what made no sense.
I think I liked Hunter in the Dark better, because I feel like the plot... I actually do feel like the plot was clear. No, it wasn't clear. It was extremely complicated, but it felt like the story was important to what was happening in the movie. And this one, like I said, it just feels like a series of events that leads us up to dynamite and rock music.
Yeah. Oh, but I just realized, so we've seen 6 movies with Nakadai in them.
Yep.
He dies in 5 of the 6.
Mm.
Do you remember the one he survives?
Hold on.
He was in Yojimbo, Sanjuro, Heatwave, Hunter in the Dark, Kajimusha, and High and Low. Yep, High and Low.
Because he was a police officer.
Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking of other Nakadai movies I've seen, and I can only think of...
He lives in the face of another.
Yeah, he lives in that.
No, he doesn't. Never mind, he gets stabbed, doesn't he?
I don't think so.
I thought that the guy who has the... is he the doctor or the guy who has the plastic surgery?
He's the guy with the plastic surgery.
Oh, no, never mind. He lives. The doctor is the one who gets stabbed.
Yeah. He just has to live, like, a bizarre existence after that.
Yeah, because nobody knows the secret.
Yeah, and...
That's why he tries to rape a woman.
Yeah, so I would definitely recommend this movie. It's entertaining. Heatwave.
Yeah, I think it's if you're looking for something kind of crazy and visually beautiful, you definitely can't go wrong. The movie was not boring at any point.
No, and like it, there's some like good little details, like the Ren is always wearing some shade of blue Like, that's always wearing blue, and Nakadai is always wearing black or white, I noticed.
Yeah.
Where is that? Oh, like, Nakadai is kind of like chill and calm the whole time, and you in the first time you see him, he's just laying down, and most of the time, like, he's just lounging around, laying down,
Well, you
just
see,
kind of.
he's like a drunk, unhappy person, it seems like, until she appears, and then all of a sudden he's more than an animated corpse.
Yeah, he found his manic pixie dream girl.
Yeah, she fixed all his problems.
Let's see. Let's see. Other 1990 movies, because we gotta do that part.
Other notable 1990 movies, like that's
We
when it
are.
comes to American film, it's a huge amount of popular things that came out. What do you got that you want to talk about?
I forgot to look until now.
Well, let me tell you two things that I think are worth mentioning. One is Slacker, which is Richard Linklater's first movie, and that's a movie that I recommend to anyone, like, because it's kind of like just a rolling non-narrative almost documentary style series of jokes, just jokey joke 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 joke, like, and I'm not talking like a straight up comedy joke, like the situations that these people and the just like the conversations that go on during the movie are like some of the funniest things, in my opinion, that I've seen on film. And basically an hour and a half of people having conversations with other people.
Is it
And
kind of like Ozu?
no, it's more like I want to say it's like a Kevin Smith, like Clerks, but not.
As vulgar?
No, it gets kind of vulgar. It's not
No.
as like childish humor. It's not
Oh,
like
okay.
they're not trying to make you laugh by being like, oh, like you've never given someone a snowball or whatever, like that. Not trying to gross out humor. They just happen to run into people that are talking about weird things. You haven't seen Slacker, I take it.
Nope.
Please watch it.
It's one I've always been curious about.
Maybe you'll hate it. Either way, I think.
Isn't it on Filmstruck?
I mean, it's on Criterion. I'm not sure if it's on Filmstruck or not.
Okay.
Yeah. And let's see, the other one I want to mention that I feel like people have to watch is Ghost Dad with, no, I'm just kidding. Not Ghost Dad.
No.
I'm gonna have to go with the inaugural podcast for Please Don't Send Me Outer Space, the movie we watched and rewatched for our 100th episode. It's Hardware by Richard Stanley. Post-apocalyptic futuristic movie where a man played by Dylan McDermott is a total dumbass, like the biggest dumbass you've ever heard of. He buys the severed head of a robot for his girlfriend because she's an artist, played by Stacey Travis.
Have you done
And
that with Sarah yet?
what, bought her a robot head?
Yeah.
She makes her own robot heads. I don't gotta buy her nothing.
Okay.
And it's a really weirdly stylized movie. Like it's totally different than a lot of the sci-fi stuff that came out in that era. It's closer in it's like raw futuristic is not that pretty. What am I trying to say? I'm trying to say that like it's not like the clean, gleaming future of, Back to the Future 2 or something like that. It's like I said, it's post-apocalyptic, so people live in hovels and stuff like that. But it's obviously the future. They've got robots, they've got lasers, they got all this stuff like that. And it really focuses on Jill, after this robot that her boyfriend bought her comes back to life and starts, you know, then it becomes kind of like escape the house, you know, horror movie thing, you know, kind of a Terminator ripoff, but not really.
Mm-hmm.
It's just done in a very MTV style, and it's violent. It's funny. William Hootkins plays a character in it. That's
Porkins.
Porkins from Star Wars. Yeah. Who is disgusting. Like, he's one of the most disgusting characters I've seen before. So if you haven't seen it, you know, take the hour and a half and check it out.
Okay. I have, Kindergarten Cop. I haven't seen it, but there's a picture of Kurosawa on the set of Kindergarten Cop with Arnold, and they're like flexing because I guess they were friends.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, and for some reason, he is just hanging out on set. I'm not quite sure why.
I mean, Kindergarten Cop is very much like a Kurosawa movie.
How?
Well, in this case, it's like Seven Samurai. Arnold goes to recruit these children to defend a town.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody gets their hand chopped off.
Oh.
Yeah, same thing.
Okay. Then there's China O'Brien.
Oh, wait. Also, boys have a penis and girls have a vagina. Anyway.
Yeah. China O'Brien came out this year.
Have you seen it?
No.
Why are you talking about
it? It stars Delaware's Cynthia Rothrock. She's from Wilmington, Delaware.
I see. Yes, We Hate Movies did a very funny episode on that.
There is a movie that's coming up on my Netflix DVD queue. That is Two Evil Eyes by Argento and Romero.
Have you seen a movie from 1990?
I've seen Goodfellas, but everyone has seen Goodfellas.
Yes. Have you seen Home Alone?
I saw it once as a kid, but I don't remember anything. Is it good?
Yeah. I mean, it's good in a cheesy kids movie kind of way.
I know I've seen it at least once. I just don't remember anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't seen much from this year. There's a Spike Lee joint, Mo Better Blues, with Denzel and Wesley.
We'll cover it next year.
Yeah, we will. Who else? Oh, Giancarlo Esposito. I like the cast.
Giancarlo Esposito.
Got Heart Condition, that We Hate Movies in episode on, Bob Hoskins plays a cop.
Cop who gets Denzel Washington's heart.
And Denzel Washington is a ghost.
Yeah, it's not. Don't watch that movie. Just listen to the We Hate Movies episode.
Yeah, Goodfellas and other ones I mentioned. Oh, and Mermaids, I've seen parts of. I haven't seen all of it yet.
Edward Scissorhands came out that year.
Oh, yeah. I liked that as a kid. I haven't seen it in, like, 15 years.
Total Recall.
Never seen it.
Paul Verhoeven, man, watch it.
I don't like him, typically.
Come on. What about RoboCop? Miller's Crossing?
No.
I think that might be my favorite Coen Brothers.
For some reason, I haven't gone back to, like, early Coen Brothers at all.
You should definitely watch Blood Simple.
Oh, I've seen Blood Simple. That's great. I've seen the Nick Cage one a bunch as a kid. Because we had it taped off of like HBO or something. Mm-hmm. And we watched it a whole bunch. Even though as a kid, I didn't like it, but I enjoyed it, if that makes any sense.
Yes.
As a kid, it didn't really register to me as a comedy. It's just kind of like, this is fun to watch.
Yeah.
But, it's a fun movie. Yeah, so 1990, year I don't know much about. Also, I wasn't born yet.
Well, that's good enough for me. What are we doing next time?
Next pairing is a little... We're going to go back to World War II, 1944. A little propaganda piece called The Most Beautiful. So we're going to learn about... who was the most beautiful, according to the Japanese government in 1944.
Uh-huh.
And we're pairing that with a Kinoshita picture called Army that's stars Kinoyo Tanaka, who was the old woman in Sandaka number 8, and she was one of the leads in Wayne Ring, and she's the first Japanese woman to direct a feature film. Who is it? Okay, it's Tanaka and Chichu Ryu. Yeah, so that's a pairing I really like. I like both those actors a whole lot. It's early Kinoshita, like one of his very first films. And it's on Filmstruck, as is Most Beautiful. And I don't think that's on Amazon, because it's kind of... That's 1944. So I should watch from 1944 movies in the meantime.
Let's see. I've got... have we already seen a 1944? Let me see.
No. It's Kurosawa's second movie, because... Sugata was 43 and 45.
I've seen two from 1944. Probably the two most famous.
Yeah, I gotta get on that at some point. Oh, yeah. Right. So, for my plugs, for Chill House 701, I just started the 5-film series Battles Without Honor and Humanity. I just reviewed the first one, which is a great, super bleak, super violent Yakuza thriller. Directed by the guy who directed Battle Royale and some other famous stuff in the 90s. And Battles Will Honor Humanity covers, like, I think from the 40s to the 70s, and the Yakuza Wars in Hiroshima. And like each movie covers like 5 to 10 years, and they are very complex and very dense, but I highly recommend it. Like, you have to watch them multiple times to be able to actually follow the plot exactly, because like characters get introduced and they freeze it and then see like a name says like underboss of the so-and-so family or captain of the family of whatever family. So it's like, and it's like 20 per movie, to points like, who am I supposed to be following exactly? But
you gotta take notes.
Oh yeah, you do. And there's a DVD box set where there's a character card for who's still alive movie to movie who gets introduced.
Check and mate.
But it's out of print now. It's like $400 to buy on Amazon. So
Patreon.
Yes. And, yeah, coming up series, Cinema Knife Fight this month. I'm going back in time to talk about Time Tunnel, a super fun 60s series about these two dudes that are stuck traveling through time or something.
So it's Quantum Leap.
Sure. Something like that. But it's a whole lot of fun. It's on Hulu and DVD. But I recommend Time Tunnel. It's so much fun.
All right. And we'll get you on this year to talk about Bamboozled. Don't send me into outer space. My podcast where I do with my two friends, Sarah and Aaron, about science fiction and fantasy movies. We took a break over the Christmas time, and plus we got super sick. The last one we did was on the movie Santa Claus Conquers the Martians. That was a lot of fun to talk about. Actually, I don't even know what we're doing, but we're planning on having a bunch of guest spots. I'm looking for requests. So we've been doing things like Ninja 3, The Domination.
Oh, and James Hogg.
We're going to be doing more recent movies, like we're covering Justice League when that's available, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. It's by request. Otherwise, I wouldn't watch it.
Okay.
But, yeah, a lot of fun stuff coming up. Please don't send me into outer space.
When am I going to be on to talk about Baffled?
Tomorrow.
Okay. I want to talk about Baffled because it's a whole lot of fun.
I'll believe it when I see it.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, so see you in 2 weeks.
Yep, listener, thanks for sticking with us.
Yep. Oh, and I promise the Studio Ghibli episode will happen at some point.
Stop promising things.
At some point.
Never. All right, bye.
See ya. You can email the show at highandlowpod@gmail.com. The show's Twitter is @highandlowpod. The show can be found on iTunes, Podbean, Podient, but only on Podient for the next month as of this recording, and wherever else you find your podcast. Thank you for listening.